Last time, 223, we talked about crying out for understanding, which was that within the difficulty of this experience, even though it's surrounded with the difficult emotions, is a meaning. And you can't just get rid of the symptom, but you have to try to understand the meaning because it is in there crying out. We talked about the garment on 224, the dirty garment, which was another image that we've seen already in the form of the storm and the Ethiopian, which was, again, the murky and difficult aspect of the experience. If it's mishandled, well, you can destroy the meaning of the experience. The couch that isn't to be defiled on 227, very similar thing. It referred to an alchemical truth, I guess you could say, that the vessel was not supposed to be overheated, and the vessel was the couch, and the defilement was the overheating. And the same idea there, if you take heating as applying attention to this problem, you can apply too much attention to it, and it actually destroys it. And what that means in our work is that we have to be very careful how we interpret what appears to be pathology, because it hides often something that is valuable. We talked about the vessel attitude at some length, which I called the third way of not acting the experience out, not repressing the experience, but sitting with it until it gives you images, and then you can understand what's behind it, namely through dreams. That's why we do the dreams. We talked about the dove as the salt of the metals, and the dove would be the meaning of the experience, and the salt of the metals is another phrase for the same thing, that there is a wisdom, the salt representing wisdom, to be pulled out of the experience. And we talked about the two meanings of salt, both as wisdom or bitterness, and the connection there being the initial experience is generally a bitter one, but you try to transform it into wisdom. And so bitterness, you can see, is untransformed wisdom. It's an initial situation. It's never been worked through. I was made young. I referred to the psychology of kingship, which we talked about quite a bit, and how Jung saw that as an externalized representation of what he was trying to establish internally, a relationship between a ruled entity, the body politic or the ego, and an authority, either a outer king or an inner king. That for Jung, the ego formation was not finished until it had reached a relationship with an internal authority. In whose embrace my body is lost on 229 was the last thing we talked about, and that was the theme of emptying. And one of the key representations of that is the moon. I'm not bringing it along. I found a beautiful moon quote. What can I do with that? I'll have to bring it next time. Not sure I put that in there. Just a second. I got it somewhere. Nope. Well, I don't know where it is. I'll have to try to find it. We'll come back to that. We'll be looking at the moon again. It's a fantastic quote about the moon. So that's where we ended on page 231. Questions? Everybody still more or less following the line?
I have a general question.
Yeah.
Well, we spend 2 hours in symbolic thought, and I tell you, getting back into the business world, the regular world, is hell. Can we make a recommendation on some sort of transitional stage to get back into...
Schnapps?
Well, I'm a little low right now. Okay. No, I mean, just see how the culture doesn't really support this kind of thinking. I mean, and certainly I got to go back to the office after I'm done here, and it's a totally different way of approaching life. And I just...
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When I was in training, I was working, you know, half time, and I'd either have to go to my personal analytic work and then go to work, or I would go to my supervisory hours and go to work, and it almost drove me nuts. So I literally scheduled an hour free before I worked, and I just go sit in a cafe and write, and that helped me transition. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We are sunk in the unconscious, and I personally needed to give myself a ritual to bridge myself back to the real world. Yeah. It's interesting, too. Often I'll tell people in analytic work, you know, if we get into something very difficult. I remember in my own therapy, just coming out of those hours, like, my head spinning, and doing things like just not watching where I was going. Mm. So I tell people, look, before you drive anywhere, go sit and have a cup of coffee for half an hour. Mm. You really do need to sort of give yourself a rite of exit.
Yeah, there's got to be some sort of transition.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. It takes a while, and you would jump in here, and then you have a little... Mm-hmm. Boy, after 2 hours, it's just...
And what it does for me is a sensation type. Of course, it activates my intuition. So I would just go write down all my intuitions and quiet them down, and then I could go back to work because it activates the interior function very often.
In connection with the unconscious.
Yeah.
Contact with the unconscious.
Contact with the unconscious activates the interior function, and I would get assaulted with really good ideas. I just needed time to write it down. Mm-hmm. And I saved those notebooks. They're really precious. Anything else? Page 231. To him, indeed, I will be a father, and he shall be to me a son. Wise is he who rejoiceth his father, him with whom I place first and highest among the kings of the earth, and I will keep my covenant faithful to him forever. Now that's the wisdom speaking, wisdom in the low form. And I think somebody raised this question, and it's something to always remember: who's speaking here? Because, as we also mentioned, when the unconscious is activated, all these voices come in helter-skelter, and you have to distinguish often who's speaking. Let's look at... by the way, some of these passages in here I'm going to go through more quickly than others. This one I want to look at a little bit more carefully. The whole ensuing part of the text tells of wisdom's promise to her lover. And if you remember, we were in a depression, and all of a sudden we have this new mood surface, which she takes there about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines down, an intuitive anticipation of a solution not yet realized. It is as though the author had suddenly leapt out of the negredo and into the ecstatic bliss of the conjunctio. So we're going to see that throughout these texts, this slipping between the darkness and hope. That is, I think, a very important... part of our work, that when people are going through difficult times, you look for the signs that it's going to work out, and you point that out to them. because otherwise it just seems so demoralizing that they can just give up, hopeless. You don't see any way forward. If you go to the bottom, well, she mentions that this phrase, I will be a father, and he shall be to me a son, is from Hebrews 1:5. It's not that important. Just so you know, there's a biblical reference behind that. And so it's in the biblical reference, the Lord speaking about Christ. And what Jung does with that is take that as a metaphor for the unconscious and the conscious, which is what she goes into in the bottom of page 231. Also Jung's view that the unconscious and the conscious stand in a father-son relationship makes it easier to understand how wisdom or the anima can describe herself as the father of the alchemist. Do you follow the symbolic logic that the unconscious says it's a father and the ego says it's a son? The father is a generative aspect that creates the son. And so the ego stands to the self as a child to the generative parent. And it owes its well-being to that relationship. Now, those of you who read in Edinger, that's what he calls the ego-self-axis. The ego is created out of another reality and is always being recreated if things are going right.
Would you much say it's in a subordinate relationship?
No, it's absolutely in a subordinate relationship. That's the whole point. Absolutely, yeah.
If the son kind of rebels, as all sons do,
yeah.
Well then, and then getting back to the community, and then gets out of the rebellion and rejoins. I don't know if that's in there, but
absolutely, it's in there. Yeah. The way that the ego first gets established is that it thinks it's the boss. We think we're the boss in our house. Just listen to Pop Psych. You know, it's all about choosing your life, making your life happen by choices, as if you have final say. And that is an important step in ego development. I don't want to underestimate it. Where you see it's in its importance, if you're working with addicts, you know, who can't choose to stop drinking, can't choose to go to work, can't choose to be faithful. So actually, the accomplishment of the ego as sovereign is an important step, but it's only the first step. Yeah.
Do you think that movie, what the Bleep, could help people that are in that?
What the Bleep was all about establishing the ego. Okay. Yeah, and the use of quantum physics as a model for establishing the ego. Yeah, definitely. And I don't think that's the deeper meaning of quantum physics at all, but that's what they were making of it. Yeah. And it's, as I say, in our work, that is much of our bread and butter, helping people decide what they want and then overcome the forces that are keeping them from getting it. But once you've achieved that ability, as far as Jung is concerned, the ego still isn't finished developing. The ego isn't finished developing until it realizes that there's another boss inside. And so recognizing that other boss, if there was a battle to establish your sovereignty, there's another battle to give it up. And I think that the two are about equally as difficult. So to let yourself be put in a subordinate position to the authority in yourself usually only occurs with great resistance. Now, how do you think we experience that in therapy? Where's the problem in therapy? The big T word.
Transference.
Yeah. Somebody will have a dream about, let's say, getting involved in something that the dream says, don't do it. So that's the inner authority saying, don't do it, or conversely, do it. So I say, the dream says, don't do it. And they say, stop talking to me like a parent. The inner axis often first plays itself out in an outer relationship. And it's almost, I think, impossible to establish that inner axis initially without the help of another person. You know, I think normally this is what works. This is what happens in a marriage that works, that each partner sees the essence of the other partner and speaks for it, if they're at all mature. And the marriage fighting, you can see, is really the externalization of the internal dialogue. And it helps cut away all the bad feelings of the person's reactions. I have seen several times in my work, it's really amazing that somebody will come in and I'll be stewing with the thought that should I tell them, should I not tell them, if I tell them it'll make them upset, and what if they can't handle it, and that's exactly what they've dreamt of. So there again, you can see the external mirrors the internal, and then it's a battle. But what we try to get to then is the acceptance that you can receive direction and it doesn't mean you're subordinate, because that direction is coming from the real you. But until you work that through, it feels like you're an adolescent again.
Gary?
Yeah.
What, somewhere I was just reading, it might have been in the dream analysis thing or whatever, but they were talking about the things in the dream are presented to us as facts, not necessarily right or wrong or black or white. Now, that seems to conflict with what you just said.
As far as I read Jung, he has said two contradictory things. And I don't totally agree with that presentation in that book, that they're just facts. Unless what he's trying to get at is that they're not moral injunctions.
Yeah, said that he wasn't trying to make, or not making a judgment as to what you should do, but presenting the things the way they were.
Yeah.
And you were supposed to figure out what to do.
What to do. My problem with that is, let's suppose, well, I'm talking to a guy right now who's in a relationship with somebody that's HIV positive. I'm thinking, holy shit. I'm not going to say do, I'm not going to say don't, but this is serious. Now, I think his dreams are going to lead him away from that relationship. Not because it's wrong, but because if he gets AIDS, he's going to die. So there I have a hard time in just saying the dream is saying you can do this or you can do that. Where when you choose one of those steps, you can accrue consequences that are lethal. That's my problem with that formation, of the way he puts it there. It'd be interesting to take that idea and compare it over the course of his lifetime. find all the places where he said that. See if he changed his mind. I think he changed his mind.
Which one was written last?
Well, see, that was written quite early.
Uh-huh.
That was very early. And to see what the final point of view was, with some of Jung's ideas where he appears to contradict himself, it's because he did contradict himself. He did change his mind.
He did evolve.
He did evolve, yeah. I think what he's trying, you know, to get put in his, ourselves in his shoes for a minute, what he's trying to get away from is that you use dreams moralistically. You know, like we saw with that woman who had the affair, the dreams could care less that she was committing adultery. In that sense, they're not moral. But I think also they do care very much whether you fulfill yourself. And whether you break conventional right or wrong in the process, they don't really care about.
Whether it helps you to individuate.
To individuate or not. So I think there is a morality there.
But maybe more practical.
Morality is the bad word because it conveys, the Old Testament right and wrong. I would say maybe the ethics of fulfillment or something like that. And we're actually, you are actually encouraged to make mistakes. Because it's the mistake you need to make. But there are other times you can't make the mistake because you die. So I appreciate your sensitivity to that question, and it's an ambiguous answer, but I don't totally agree with what he said in that book to give you a short answer. Yeah, and I have contradicted that. Okay, another point. We'll come back to that in just a second. I've lost the passage. I wanted to, where is that? Well, somewhere she makes reference to wisdom saying, that man shall walk in my ways. Now, what does she say? Where did she say that?
But you shall forsake my law and walk not in my ways.
232 is here, walk in my ways.
Yeah, but where is it in the passage?
Well, over here on this side, it says, and not walk not in my ways.
If he shall walk in my ways.
Page 230. Okay, so she's anticipating. Yeah, okay, right, she's anticipating. I knew it was there somewhere. I just want to talk a little bit about that phrase, walk in my ways. So, you see, we've got first the announcement of the father-son image. And then we're going to be looking at this whole theme of the enemy. And she's saying that the antidote to be infected by the enemy, which we'll look at in a second. And the way that you, to go back to the image network now we're talking about, the way that you establish the relationship of the ego to the self as the son to the father, is that you have to walk in wisdom's ways. That's what I wanted to get at. What's that about?
What was that very last thing you said?
What's it mean when wisdom says, walk in my ways?
What?
I heard somebody say something. No. Oh.
Well, would that be for the ego to follow the ways of the self?
Right. Yeah. What's emphasized here is the idea that the ego has to very carefully watch all the images that follow on this experience. Now, that's not maybe something too terribly new, but the sentence he mentions a little further down does give us, I think, some cause for reflection, and that is the sentence, you take that long paragraph, and you go up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines. The anima is not calling Christ to her aid, but a human ego. What is so important about that? If you take that big paragraph on 232, you know, it starts in the third line there, and then you go to the bottom of it, and you count up 8. The anima is not calling Christ to her aid, but a human ego.
What's the substance for those? There has to be something that has to be transformed by the encounter with the unconscious. And so it's the ego. It has to be strong enough to withstand the connection, the contact. So, I mean, there has to be a strong enough ego to handle it. So
there's also a theological implication here.
Well, I wouldn't know about that.
And it goes on to say that something about the conception of Christ as the bridegroom of the soul.
Right. What it does is emphasizes the importance of the ego. It emphasizes the importance of the ego. You see, what is required for salvation isn't Christ, but the ego. Now, we'll follow up the consequences of that in a minute. But we've been talking, you know, we're talking about this text on many different levels. And one of them is the anticipation of another religious worldview. And it looks like this could be one of the features of it. That the ego is emphasized as the savior. It's not that a savior saves the ego. It's that the ego follows and saves wisdom.
Is that kind of getting into like a reconcile of third kind of maybe?
Go ahead.
We are the cure, you know what I mean, being that it has to take place in us. You know what I mean?
Same idea.
The physical, you know.
Same idea. Same idea. Okay. Yeah. And what she's implying with the passages that Mary referred to is that the image of Christ that is medieval, and remember this is a medieval text, is of surrender. But what this text is saying, what is required, is action. And I think you can see the Gnostic thread here, hopefully. You see why I say that? If you don't, holler. Well, the Gnostic idea, remember at the beginning of Christianity, this is not Jungian psychology, this is straight history of religions, there were two competing interpretations for what actually happened. And one interpretation is now what we call Orthodox, and the other interpretation is what we now call Gnostic. And the Orthodox made the Gnostic heretical. And in the Orthodox paradigm, Christ was sent to redeem us. And in the Gnostic paradigm, Christ was sent to teach us how to redeem God. And in the Orthodox understanding, the person in need of redemption is us. And in the Gnostic interpretation, the person in need of redemption is God. Because it's God who loses at creation. And then we have to live in a way that God gets all of himself back at the end of the story.
Well, isn't it, but in a way, it's both. To me, I kind of see those as the opposite of the same thing. I mean, if God, if we're there to save God, if we also save, I mean, it's intertwined. God in us mean we're seeing God and we're seeing ourselves.
Well, that's what common sense would say. It's just not what the church says.
Right. But it's starting to change.
It's starting to change, and I think this is an indication of the change which we're in.
And it's starting to change in the Christian faith, too. I mean, some of that.
Necessary.
So you're speaking of the God image.
What are you saying with
that? Yeah.
That's the big difference.
Well, yeah, it is. Our experience of.
Right, our experience of God.
So, Gary, what are you saying about the threat?
Well, yeah, the established church saw this as a threat, saw Gnosticism as a threat. Because see, it places responsibility individual. If we're doing the work, who needs the church? The early position. Yeah, it's based on fear of the unconscious. Right.
It's not that I'm aware of it.
Right. Right. So now I think we get to the heart of the matter at the paragraph near the bottom of 232 where it says, But what does the anima really want with her extraordinary urgent courtship? She wants, as the text says, to establish a relationship which is paralleled with that of God the Father to his Son. Nothing new there. In the text itself, it looks as if not just a parallel, but an identity were meant. Yet this is not possible when we consider the biblical context. It can only be a parallel. Anima wisdom relates to the alchemist as God to Christ. Does that make sense? It's almost blasphemy. So what the text is saying symbolically in this new paradigm, the wisdom asks the ego to follow it. That would be the psychological way of putting it. Another way of putting it is the anima or the unconscious asks the ego to relate to it as a son to a father. But the original biblical reference was that Father was God and the Son was Christ. Ergo, it puts the ego in the place of Christ. And that's what I want to try to understand. So again, the implication, if we take this Sophia experience as anticipating a new world view or a new religious view, it is that the ego gets put in the place of Christ. But we have to talk about this very carefully. Now, I was racking my brains how to present this, and I think a little detour might help. I believe it's safe to say, from the point of view of our terminology, that what we're experiencing today in the cult of narcissism, I call it the me, SUV, cell phone worldview, is that people are becoming Christ. They're acting like gods. But in the wrong way. So what happens when God dies? In other words, when fewer and fewer people have a meaningful relationship to the church, to religious experience, this is what, to the values that, have kept us afloat for 2,000 years, is that that relationship between the ego and the projected self is broken. Is this making sense?
Mm-hmm.
When in a secular time like our time, when nobody really takes religion seriously, few people take God seriously, the old worldview of worshiping God was based on the fact that we projected the self onto God and we worshiped these central values and this experience of centrality out there. But when that experience doesn't happen anymore, the thing that we used to see out there possesses us. So we don't worship God, we act as gods. So this is Jung's understanding of self-centeredness. That the ego has become identified with Christ. And if you just think the way people behave, the need to be adored, well, read the Old Testament. The absolute arrogant conviction of what's right and wrong, basically what serves me, well, that's Yahweh. If you look at the personality characteristics which are running our era, they are qualities that once were ascribed to Yahweh. Yeah, get out of my way, worship me. That's what Yahweh said when he saw the Canaanites. Same thing. Except now it drives a Lexus. You don't find it funny.
I do find it funny.
Well, you have to have a sense of humor about it.
Yeah.
And that's why these people are so difficult to deal with. You're dealing with a bunch of little gods who are not interested in listening and are interested in being worshipped and listened to. Okay, what's the way out of that situation? That's what this text, I think, is giving us a way to understand. It's saying there are two ways to become Christ. And that's not the right way to put it, but I'm just trying to build a bridge. The old way was to worship Christ. Or, now I'll use my Jungian vocabulary, the old way was to worship the self projected onto Christ. Because that Christ figure got its power because it represented something in us. It carried part of our own personality. Which is not to say that God is nothing but this is the way it works when we try to experience it. Our own human psyche shapes the experience. So we worship the self, the God dies, then we become the self. Or we worship God, the God dies, and we become godlike. Same thing. We worship the self. I have to choose my metaphors. If I use the Jungian vocabulary, the big S, when the... I'll use the first way. That in religious language, you first worship God. But then when that experience doesn't work anymore, that energy doesn't go away. It just falls back. The thing you once worshipped falls back into yourself and you become it. Hence our modern arrogance.
They get projected onto them on the cars and the cell phones and stuff.
Yeah.
Because that energy still has to be realized through projection.
And very often, I don't even think it's the car and so on. It merely is an extension of the sense of the person's omnipotence. What we're dealing with is the experience that I'm omnipotent. And I'm not beholden to anybody.
And that's the danger we're talking about with that
statement. Well, I'm trying to present a context for this statement, because it's difficult to understand, and I wanted to try to show why I think it's so important. What I've described so far, I would call inauthentic solution one, inauthentic solution two, compared to this. But I've been trying to put a context for it. What I want to leave you with is that there is this need which you cannot argue away to be in touch with the numinous, with the divine. It is a fundamental constituent of us. And up to now we've had the way of staying in touch with that by worshiping it. Now we're seeing the way of staying in touch with that is to become it. So the irony is that all these atheists who say there is no God are gods. And unbeknownst to themselves, they can't let go of that numinous. You know what I mean by numinous? Okay.
Spirit.
Yeah, the experience of spirit, which is awesome, powerful, you know, goosebump producing.
Well, it's
interesting. Yeah, people say, "Oh, that was an awesome." That, I don't know. That's an awesome MP3 player. I say, "So if that's awesome, what's God?" You know.
Really
awesome. super awesome. let me just say this: if you haven't heard this. The way I like to think of numinous is it in its original meaning, that it originally meant to nod, and a numen was a nod, and it was thought that it was a Greek word, if you looked at a statue long enough, it would move, it would nod to you, and that's numinous. So if you can imagine, there you are looking at David in Florence, and he winks at you. Imagine what you would feel. That's numinous. It's a hard word to translate, but the best I can describe it is this goosebump feeling, like, holy smokes, what just happened? And it gives you a warm, tingly, somewhat teary feeling that you've just experienced something that doesn't ordinarily happen, and that is marvelous, and that's numinous. So, if you don't worship the numinous, you become numinous. And you don't worship the awesome, your cell phone is awesome. I think it absolutely fits. And you can't get rid of the awesome, you can't get rid of the numinous. So, now let's go back to our text. I took a detour to try to explain why I think this is so important. See, in the text, the anima is asking the ego to become Christ too, but in a different way. And the way I would try to explain it, and I think this is the answer to the death of God, and this is the answer to contemporary narcissism. In a way, the narcissist has an advantage. They know there is something of central importance. They just happen to think they are that thing of central importance. But at least they're not willing to let go of this fact that there is something in life of central importance. Now, with this text, the thing it's also, by the way, why you never use the word narcissism. I think you'll find it twice in 40 volumes. Because he sees it not as self-centeredness, but as being possessed by the numinous, which is a holding pattern until another understanding of how to connect with the numinous comes along. And here we've got the other paradigm expressed. And that is, you serve the self. Now, when you serve the self, when you are, you know, walking, as she says, walking, in her ways. What's the exact phrase? Walking in my ways. When you are following those dreams, dream by dream by dream, when you are hearing what you are being asked to do in time and space, in life, as your inner center is requesting it, and as you fulfill that, your ego begins to accrue luminosity. You begin to feel special. But it is not a specialness that has to broadcast. It's not a special that has to be seen. It's not a special that has to bully. It's a quiet confidence that something very right is happening here, and that something very right is you. And it's quiet. But it is, and Jung's word is, it's a Christification of the ego. But I wanted to be so careful how we understood this. It is not where the ego identifies with the self, which is our current solution to the death of God. But it's where the ego comes into a confidence, and I think confidence is maybe even the best word, a self-confidence, and a sense of important. Not because it's important, but because it knows, so to speak, or I know, that important work is being done through me. And because the work is important, I don't have to be important. If you've ever met truly important people who have shaped history, they're generally very quiet and humble about it. They don't have to make a noise because their work is making the noise. And I think that's what she says here, the unconscious symbolism thus expresses that progressive Christification of the individual, the importance of which is discussed by Jung in Answer to Job, together with its religious background. The unconscious symbolism thus expresses that progressive Christification of the individual, the importance of which is discussed by Jung in Answer to Job, together with its religious background. That's what I've tried to do here. Give you the background for what this means culturally, why this is the solution that is coming up now, what have the wrong solutions looked like, and then what it looks like clinically. Something happens to the person who is fulfilling from the inside what in religious language you would call the will of God. They calm down. They get more generous. They know how to shut up. They know how to listen. They know how to give. This is the ultimate solution to self-centeredness. So there's been a lot of talk about this in the Freudian schools, about what is self-centeredness and how do you cure it. And they largely take it as a disturbance between the child and the mother. The mother never saw the child adequately, so the child always goes through life needing to be seen. I don't think that's incorrect. I think that's always in there. This isn't an either-or. But I don't think their way of understanding it solves the problem. I think they have a necessary contribution to make, but not a sufficient contribution, because until you're serving the self, you don't ever get rid of that emptiness. And when that emptiness is there, then you need to be a big shot. So what the anima is doing here in that little silly couple of sentences of father to son and walk in my ways is lay the groundwork for a new understanding of what Christ is. ego begins to feel that numinous energy. The best way I can describe it is you can see it in these people's twinkles in their eyes. So we go on now. The ordinary man is chosen to be the place of God's birth. So again, now she's just taking taking that very basic shift and looking at its theological implications, that we become the birthplace of Christ. Or in doing our work, the self is put into reality, or the self or Christ is put into reality. And in him is incarnated not only as in Christ the light side of Yahweh. In him God regenerates himself as a totality in both his light and dark aspects. So the plot thickens. And we'll see that thicken in a moment. This is what Tom was referring to, I think, in needing to be able to stand incarnating the self. Because you don't just get the light side, you get both sides together. And the dark sides, of course, in the text would be the storm, the Ethiopians, and the garden, so far.
The guardian?
The garment.
Oh, garment.
And a little farther down, this is what causes God to adopt the kindly father attitude. In other words, that's what allows the self to transform from a persecuting to a benevolent presence.
Talk a little bit about what she says about the dark aspect of wisdom.
Coming right
we
up.
We spoke about
it. It's coming right in the next passage. We'll spend considerable time on that. I think it might be time for a break at the moment. Any questions? Just have a stretch and we'll come back and we'll pick up with Carol's question.